Do you need to raise your land and business to new heights? Then you need to call Evergreen Development and Construction. They do it all, from land development, construction, drainage, excavating, site prep, and even environmental projects. No job is too big for Evergreen Development and Construction. Give them a call at 813-478-8847. And don't forget to check out the late model Evergreen Development Construction Race Team. They'll be at a track near you. And remember, just think green. Evergreen Development and Construction. 813-478-8847.
The following is a presentation of Real Racin' USA.
I think we're ready for our first guest tonight. I'll let you do the honors, Carol.
Pete.
Yes.
Hey, welcome to Inside Florida Racing.
Well, thank you very much.
What an honor and a pleasure to have you on our show.
Well, I'm up here in Maine tonight at our summer cottage, and we weren't doing too well on our connection. The cell phones, sometimes they don't work that good out in the woods.
Oh, I thought you were down here in sunny, rainy Florida.
Well, we live in Florida, down in the Florida Keys in the wintertime, but we're up here in Maine, been coming up to this lake, same lake all my life.
We were just talking about the big nostalgia reunion that we have planned over there at New Smyrna during Speed Week. And, of course, you're going to be there, right?
Well, I'm certainly going to try to. It kind of depends on when we're down there. My wife and I will be going down there. They're getting together all the past winners of the Daytona 500 and celebrate the 50th anniversary of the running of the Daytona 500. And that would be this coming February. We were all down there the 4th of July, and it was just amazingly fun to be there with those guys and all the stories and the lies, and, well, you know what it's like when a bunch of old racers get together. There's no telling what's going to happen.
It's almost like fishermen, right?
Right.
Well, we're going to, that's going to be the most exciting, fun thing that I think's ever happened in the state of Florida, getting all you guys back together.
Well, now this is going to be over at New Smyrna Speedway, right?
Yes, on February 15th, I believe it is.
Okay. Well, I know that racetrack was mighty good to me. We won a lot of races over there.
You won a lot of races everywhere, Pete.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I think you were about 20 when I first saw you at Norwood Arena.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Is that about the right age at Norwood?
When I actually started running what they call a street stock when I was 19, and I ran for just a few races, and then the following year we come back and started running a hobby car, and so I ended up running all the divisions that Norwood Arena had to offer, and finally, finally got into the modifieds, and that was a big jump from the street stock to them in about a little bit over a year.
Well, you went on to much bigger and better things after that, that's for sure.
Well, we were very fortunate, and I don't know how much ability I had, but I had a lot of desire. I think probably if there's one thing that a race car driver, even to this very day, that he can have, it's nice to have ability and all that, but it's crucial to have that desire. And that helped me a lot. It carried me a long way when we might not be the fastest, but we just kind of kept hanging in there and by doing that we won our share of races
and championships.
Well, that too.
You're too modest.
The championship that we won down here in New England, it kind of propelled us down to move south was the National Sportsman Championship, and that year Bugsy Stevens won his first modified championship, and Richard Petty was the Winston Cup. In those days we called it the Grand National. So the three of us were on the podium together, and and that was down there at Daytona, and they had it over at the Plaza Hotel on Daytona Beach, and there was probably, oh, maybe the maximum of, you know, if there was 200 people, I would say probably even less than that attended that thing. And so you can see, even in the dinners that they have today, that there's been some mighty big changes in NASCAR.
Pete, I got a question for you. This is Mark Keeler.
Mark.
I see you. I know you're from Dedham, Massachusetts. Is that correct?
That's where I was living when I won the championship.
Okay. Yeah. I was born and raised in Needham.
Needham is actually where we worked on the race cars, and where I, you know, we were six and a half days out of seven in Needham. We, you know, sometimes we'd spend all night at the garage over there. Jack Malone,
yep,
had the Speedway Alley, and I didn't have any money. I didn't, you know, most of us didn't have any money in those days at all. And Jack, he gave me a garage to use, which was amazing, which was a mighty big thing that helped me. And Jack helped me out in other ways, primarily in at the racetrack, and going out and running with me and against me and showing me. He'd drive my car and I'd drive his. But he really is the one that got me going over there at Norwood Arena.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that the old gasoline alley there off Chestnut Street, because growing up as a kid, I would walk 2.5 miles a day past that garage on the chance. And I'm sure you'll know the name George Savory.
Oh, yeah.
He was my idol growing up, and I'd walk by just on the off chance he had the garage door open, and I might be able to see the car. Later on, when he was driving Pro 4s in the early 90s, I actually got to hang out at the shop with him quite a bit.
Well,
so that was special.
George is a good guy. I saw him a couple of weeks ago. We were down there in Needham to visit with some friends, and I got to see George. He was working on a 32 Roadster.
Yep.
He does a lot of that now.
Yeah, he hung up the racing gloves and decided to collect some classic cars there. But some other names that came out of Gasoline Alley, or at least that general area, naturally Bobby Melnick had
right.
cars there, the Bakiokis, or
right.
Bob Bakioki, and then later Doug. Now, did Don McTavish have his car there at all?
No, Mac never worked out of that with us. I mean, there were different times when all of us, I think, went over to Dover, which was
mm-hmm.
probably 6-7 miles away, and helped him on his car. You know, we would work with him, and I know I worked with Mac, a little bit to try to help out, because he was running for the championship, and none of the rest of us at that point were. And the same thing happened to me a year later when I ran for the championship. Is a lot of people showed up and kind of helped, and when, you know, we'd crash a car and it looked like we wouldn't possibly make it to the racetrack the next day. People would magically show up and help, and without that, I don't think there's any way that I would have won the championship or Mac either.
One more quick question for you. I've got an old picture at my house that it predates me by quite a few years, but it's George Savory's old Vega wagon modified.
Uh-huh.
My dad tells me there's quite an interesting story behind that car, and he thinks it's that particular one, but it was a car that you had actually built that was going to be modeled after a kit car. Or the kit car was going to be modeled after that car, and then later was turned into a modified for George and then Bob Bakioki. But he tells me that originally came. That was a Pete Hamilton car at one point in time.
Yes, we built the first station wagon that George had. We built, and it was largely modified after the Chrysler kit car deal. The first year that came out was 72, and we had one, and Harry Hyde had one, and a couple other teams had one. A couple other teams had them and never really raced them much. Because I wasn't running a cup car at the time, I ran mine a good bit. And so we learned a lot about it. And I was building cars for other people during that period of time. And we built a car for George, and that baby hauled ass.
Yeah, it's one of the best pictures I have, one of my favorite pictures. It was actually taken at the infield at Seekonk, which was a track that I grew up at. I think Westboro had closed down when I was in my earlier days, and, of course, Norwood was a little before my time. My father actually used to be the fireman at Norwood in the late 60s.
Well, for good. Seekonk is a great place. That's where we brought that car up north, and I came up with it, and George took his old car to Seekonk, and I took the new station wagon to Seekonk, and we ran both cars that day for a little test, and immediately it went really good, and I had never been up. I had run Seekonk a few times with a modified, but I'd never really not this type of a car. And we had a lot of fun, doing that. And George had a lot of success at Seekonk.
Yeah, modifieds. Actually, when I was growing up, he always had a Pro Stock and what they called Seekonk modifieds, which later became the Mini modifieds and then the Pro Fours.
Oh, for goodness' sakes! Yeah, George really did good with those Pro Fours too.
Oh, he was unbeatable.
Another name, Bob Bakioki.
Oh, yeah.
He was the one that actually got me into racing to begin with. I was working at his gas station down in Newton and Needham Street, just going out of Needham and into Newton. And I was working at his gas station. He was racing a hobby car at Norwood, and I went over there a few times and watched him. And I decided I had to do that. And so that first year, he was the guy kicking me in the butt. I had some good guys that really helped me all the way along.
Yeah, I grew up, Bob's son, Doug, is just a few years older than me. He's actually the same age as my older brother. And when Doug got into it, I kind of hung around their cars. But unfortunately, never got to see Bob and Jack and all them. I race cars. I got to see Kerry Malone, who's still going at it.
Yeah,
Jack's son, Kerry. And actually, George's son, Richard, is running the Wheeling Modified Tour, and he's had some success with it this year, too.
Yes, he has.
So, it's great to talk to you. Actually, Carol Wicks, the other host here with me, she's actually from Newton, Massachusetts.
Oh, for goodness sake. Well, that's the town that I was born in. I was born in Newton Wellesley Hospital, and I lived in Newton all my life. And my folks moved away, and so Butchie Walsh and I ended up getting a third-story apartment over in Dedham, and it had no heat. And we froze our ass off one time up there. I'm telling you. But he was running midgets at the time.
Yep.
For Mike Scavani, and I was driving for Worcester Sand. And so we were hardly ever there. So it actually worked out pretty good.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Last I knew, Butchie was living over in Dover.
He's down in the Cape now.
Oh, did he? Okay. Well, I moved out of
down there. He got a farm. He sold his mom, and mom passed away, and they sold that place, and he went down and bought a farm. And I think the barn is full of motorcycles.
Yep, it was, as long as I knew it, when he lived in Dover there. This was after he was racing midgets, early 90s, and he was actually working for George in the body shop.
Oh, yeah, he worked for George for a bunch of years.
Yep.
What's the biggest, most exciting event in your racing career?
Wow. I guess, winning both Talladegas in one year was a really exciting thing, particularly the second one, because as the laps wound down, I began to realize that I had a chance to do something that no one had done at that particular time, because Talladega at that point was a pretty new racetrack for us. And so it wound down, and that was pretty exciting when I took the checkered flag for that, winning the both legs that year. That was exciting. But I'd have to say, without question, that the most exciting race for me would be the Daytona 500.
I would imagine it probably was.
I mean, that's the one that receives a lot of the publicity. I was telling my wife just the other day, I said, it was kind of funny. At the time, we couldn't quite run wide open down there. We were running a 426 Hemi, and it was, about 10,000ths overboard, so it was 430, and it had a lot of torque, and it had pretty good horsepower. It had a little bit better horsepower than what they have on the big tracks today, but they're running a lot smaller motor. And we had a good body on those cars, so it didn't have much drag, and those cars would easily run over 200. They'd run, at Daytona, we run 203, 205 every once in a while in a good draft. But at the last lap, once I took that last lap and saw that checkered flag, I wanted to make damn sure and I was gonna that there was not going to be anything wrong, and I never even let off on that baby. I sunk that thing down in the first turn and slid damn near to the wall because I was gonna make sure that that I was gonna take another lap, and I did, and that last. The tires by that time were pretty well wore because we had about 15 laps on a new set of tires. And I took this gigantic slide for life in one and two and went up and got close to the wall and went, I was okay down a backstretch, two, three, and four. And finally coming off four, I think I might have backed off, a little bit. So I didn't run 200 laps. I ran 201.
Go ahead.
Just a personal opinion, or actually I'd like to get your opinion. NASCAR back in those days was kind of all about the modifieds and the prestige of those big racetracks. And it was more of the racers were more accessible from the fans' point of view, and I think that helped the sport quite a bit. Now, naturally, NASCAR made a great model in bringing the sport into what it is today. What's your opinion on NASCAR and especially the Cup cars in particular, and where it stands right now with the actual racing fan and how it's progressed?
Well, it's been being involved from several years before I even went to Daytona. Eddie Flemke took me to Daytona for the first time. I rode down there with he and Eddie and a couple other guys from New Britain, and we stayed down there and went down, saw his sister in Miami, and we took a look around, and you're right, it was a lot easier to get to the race drivers in those days than it is now. To me it looks like a slow progression. Because when you see a track, go from 50,000-60,000 people to eventually 100,000 to 130,000 to 160,000 to I don't even know what they have now at Daytona, 180, something like that, maybe even a couple hundred thousand with the infield, I don't know. But one of the demands on the guy driving a hot rod are a lot different, and. If you've got 50,000 people and 10% want to have an autograph, that's 5,000 people. If you've got 10% of the people that want to have an autograph today, that's 20,000 people, and that's a lot of difference. And what that means is, every moment of every time at the racetrack, if you're not driving a car, you actually could be probably standing out there with a big long line and signing hats and signing different things and pictures and stuff, and it always has been important for the racers to have that access and to be able to do that. The problem that most of the racers have today is the demand put on them by the sponsors that put up a tremendous amount of money, and they would like to, they during race week, they want you here, they want you there, they'd like you at this hospitality tent, they'd like you to come to this dinner, please come to this breakfast, and of course, everything, you try to do it all, and what really gets, just as you pointed out, what really gets shuffled to the back, unfortunately, is the fan, and, the fan, has in NASCAR and all kind of racing, the fan has always, paid the freight and made it possible. Without people sitting in the grandstands, there wouldn't be any races. So I hope that, as time goes on, we can still get the racer where he's accessible. Unfortunately, they're a lot less accessible now than they were before. When we were down there the 4th of July, there was about 21 or 23 of the guys that have won the Daytona 500 that were there, and about half of them were current, current people or they had different jobs to do and stuff like that. Well, it was probably 8 or 10 of us old farts that were there that we had almost unlimited time. And I will tell you that having unlimited time was absolutely full with talking with the people, with signing autographs. And for a fellow like me, it's 35 years. It was, you know, it'll be 38 years come February since I won that race. And that's a long time. Most of the fans weren't even born when that happened. When the first Daytona 500, I won the 12th one. So, in other words, we're dealing with folks that go, "Jesus, it's nice to see you, Mr. Hamilton." I said, "No one calls me that but my banker." You know, I mean, and so it's kind of humorous. But I think that I know the old people, the older guys that were there, really appreciated the people coming up, and because they appreciate what NASCAR has done done for us. No, we didn't make a lot of money. Most of us, you know, Ned Jarrett was saying, "Hell, he won, you know, a national championship and won a lot of races and all. I never made $100,000." And today, what they pay at Daytona for last place, mind you, is more than I won in my whole NASCAR Grand National.
Oh my God!
So I mean, when you in other words, like my wife said to me the other day, she said, "You know, you were just born 25 years too early."
Mm-hmm. We're speaking here with NASCAR legend Pete Hamilton. Pete, what about the drivers and I mean those points you just made? That's absolutely, I mean, it's fascinating insight. And but what about the drivers and the talent? Yoel Kodgers, how you guys look at these young whips?
I think to a man, everybody looks at these guys that are driving today as just as talented in every way as any other guy that's wheeled a race car, whether it's an Indy car or a stock car or Formula One or whatever, or, you know, sports car running. You know, I did a little bit of that. We won a race on 4th of July one time running. The race started at midnight down there at Daytona. It was called the Paul Revere 250, and it was pretty much run in darkness. If we didn't have headlights on our race cars, we would have never finished the race. We wouldn't be able to see where the hell we were going. But I think that there's a lot of respect up and down the line. I spent a lot of time with Junior, with Earnhardt, and with Jimmy Johnson, and talked with them quite a bit about it. And, of course, they had a lot of questions about in the past. Maybe one of the biggest differences between then and now is the weight of the drivers. We were bigger. A lot of us were bigger men, you know, weighed well over 200 pounds. Because none of the cars had power steering, they steered harder, and so if you still had to sit there and run a 500 mile show, but you didn't have power steering, and every once in a while, one of these guys will lose his power steering or lose the power steering belt or something like that, and they find out about it, and they realize that is mighty critical today. To keep these cars going, because it's hard to drive one for 500 miles without that. And Richard and I were talking about that down there too. He said, "You know, we were a little bit bigger, you know, in those days physically. Now today, there's a certain advantage in having a lighter race driver, because you're carrying less weight around." Well, we didn't really think about that then.
It's
Tiny Lund and Buddy Baker. Hell, they both weighed 230, 240. And, you know, they were bigger. And then, you know, I was around 200, and so was Richard, and, you know, Glotzback and Bobby Allison and all the rest.
Well, when you look at what's coming up, like when you go to the racing divisions that are, you know, like feeder-type series or where people are, young drivers are learning the craft and the trade, you don't see too many big ones. There's some really tiny. I think they're getting smaller, Pete.
They are. They're getting there. They are. That's right. If they were to sit in those old cars of ours, they'd need wooden blocks on the pedals. But you're absolutely right. They are smaller men. But you know, that they're just as ferocious in their desire to win as we were then. There is no different. I see it all the time. Right now, NASCAR has got a wonderful crop of race drivers, mm-hmm. and I mean there is a lot of guys that have won races in the past that are still racing or that are coming and just getting started. There is a NASCAR, to me at least, is tremendously healthy at this point. And you know, I came up here and green flagged the start of the spring sizzler up here at Stafford, there certainly was nothing wrong with that race. They had a real good crowd. They had a good race. A lot of competitive things. The competitive juices were flowing. Stafford Springs looked just as good as it ever did to me. It looked like it was doing great.
Well, Pete, we're getting close to time here, and I am so looking forward to seeing you on February 15th. I don't know how to thank you for being on the show. It's been...
And, Pete, before you go, you're going to do what's the deal now at Daytona as well with all of previous winners getting together? What's that deal?
We I'm not sure. They haven't got the itinerary to us yet, but I do know that Susie and I will be there for a period of time, and I would imagine that we would be there during the 15th.
All right, and then you'll be there for the...
It's about an 8-hour drive up from Big Pine Key where we live, and I feel pretty certain that we'll be there and get to see Bugsy and some of my old buddies.
I will email you the list of people we have so far. You'll be amazed.
Oh, great!
Yeah, well, we look forward to talking with you again in February and having you back on the air with us, man.
Thank you so much, Pete. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful trip and be safe.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Pete. Good night.
Bye.
And there you have it.
Well, that took me back to my roots just a little bit.
Me too. Oh, my goodness.
He name-dropped Butchie Walsh, who used to drive midgets. And I seen a post on here on the message board a couple weeks back. They were talking about the safety in that. And it was actually a video, and they said, what's wrong with this video? One of the replies to that was the gentleman was driving with his thumbs under the steering wheel, like wrapped around it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Pete Hamilton used to drive, and of course, the midget cars, the steering wheels are flat almost. They're almost parallel to the ground. Well, he used to drive. What was most comfortable for him was to kind of hook his thumb underneath the fork of the steering wheel on either side. Well, he hit the wall one time really hard. And to this day, his thumbs actually are as long as his middle finger.
Who is that?
Butchie Walsh.
Oh, okay.
And because all that extra tissue in there on your thumb was dug out. And if he saw anybody to this day drive with their thumbs around or hooked under a steering wheel, he would just go nuts on them and teach them not to do that.
I saw that on the Karnak board, yep. And I was wondering what they were talking about.
Inside Florida Racing.